Hello, and welcome to Introducing Me. I'm your host, Sarah. I started this podcast to get to know other people and lifestyles while discovering more about myself. Each episode, I'll give a new guest a chance to discuss their background, culture, interests, or whatever they want to talk about to help increase all of our own worldviews. Today, I would like to introduce you to Brian. Brian is here to talk about his life starting in high school. He was very much an athletics guy and what sort of troubles he spent in high school and the experiences he had there. And then now he is really into electoral form. He is living in Virginia. And if you are friends with him on social media, you will see all of the good information that he is sharing out. And he's doing a lot of good things for the area. So I'm very thankful for Brian to be here. So Brian, why don't you go ahead and say hello?
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me. Nice to be a part of this.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. So why don't we go ahead? Why don't you tell us, I gave in the intro a little sneak peek. Do you want to explain what high school was like for you? And we'll just start there.
Yeah. So I went to high school in Central Virginia, and my whole identity, like my whole life, was wrapped up around being a sports guy, like a jock. I was like in the honors classes, blah, 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 but I didn't care about any of that. All I cared about was football. And I had a lot of luck or fortune early in high school where I was, I was starting quarterback on varsity or junior varsity. I went up to the varsity and we had a really good football program, and we're not Friday Night Lights or anything in where I grew up, but it's not far from it. We definitely had people go pro who played football for us, who I played with. But we got to my sophomore year, I ended up being the backup quarterback on the varsity team, which is like a big deal. And I thought I was really cool. And I actually threw the first touchdown pass of the season. And like, we would win the division every year. We were like in the biggest division, in the biggest kind of conference, we'd win the division every year. We were really good. And then my junior year in the summer, when we were preparing for football, I got beat out by a up and coming sophomore kid, who was unequivocally better. He played college ball, and that was never in my plans. And he was like, he could run like a 4.3 40, and he could throw it on a rope at 50 yards. Like, he was very talented. I was so bitter by that, Sarah. It like cut me to my core, because it was like my identity, right? And all of a sudden now I'm like, I'm never starting at this school. I always thought I would start. That was my thing. That was my goal. And now I'm not going to start. So I had really adjust my life in a lot of ways. And I had a principal who did a lot of really kind of helping and coaching me to get to be to focus my life somewhere else, which was important then. But I also looked back and had some like really quickly some interesting insights about the person who beat me out. So it's weird to look back and learn so much from the thing that I was like completely misguided to have all my eggs in that basket.
So why was being varsity and being the quarterback so important to you that you had this visceral reaction?
So it really was just all I'd ever wanted to do. And I was pretty good at it. So I got a lot of praise for doing it growing up. I loved the sport in general. I still love the sport. It really was just like what I thought I was good at and what I should try to do. And as I got into high school, I realized I was never going to play it in college. Like, so this was it for my whole life of playing like real football in pads on a team. Like, those were my 4 years, and that's how I viewed it. And it's true. Like, I have never put on pads since then. It just means a lot less now than it did anyway. So yeah, it's just like, it was a sadly myopic view of my capabilities and my value to the world. But that's really what I thought it was. I mean, the world seemed like high school.
Yeah, it definitely, when you're in high school is like the thing to look forward to. Now, did you have any problems when the student beat you out? If you had kind of always been top dog, what was the situation like for you?
It was humbling. So I hadn't been top dog at the high school level yet. And that's, I always felt I was in that lane. And then that was just a matter of, well, when I'm a junior, then I'll be the starter. But it was really frustrating because I think it was like the second game of the season, the guy who beat me out threw like five interceptions and we lost to our local rival. Like he did he had a horrible game. And I went to the coach the next day on Monday and met him in his classroom. And I was like, coach, I don't know what I got to do to start. Like, obviously the other guy is not doing it. And the coach like praised me for how well I was handling losing, basically. And I just was furious about that. And I was like, I don't want to lose. What are you talking about? We play to win. Like, huh? And I mean, obviously he was right in the long run. The kid did well. And maybe I should have played a couple more games or whatever, but like he was right. And I had to adjust my own kind of mindset there.
Cool. So, of course, it's always difficult and very humbling when you learn, you know, that a big goal is not going to happen. And especially high school, you know, a big growing point in your life. So what sort of lessons have you learned and taken from that you've been able to help yourself now and what it was like then for you?
Well, my principal at the time, because I actually went to him, was like, I need to transfer schools. I got to transfer somewhere, anywhere else in the county. I could go play and I could start quarterback there. And I've only got, you know, one more year to do this. This is all I have in life. And he was like, you're dumb. Don't do that. So the principal, Dr. Tyler, now it's Dr. Tyler, he's Mr. Tyler at the time, told me to focus on my leadership. He was like, that's what you like about football is your leadership stuff. And you've got that in spades. So go do that. And I did. I had a great senior year because of that advice and him not basically not letting me transfer. Because he was like, you can go. I'm just not going to sign the waiver to let you play football. but the other real thing, and I think about this more and more and more, as I become more and more aware of privilege and you know, I'm a white guy. So, you know, it's my job. It wasn't like I was ever on the short end of anybody's, discrimination stick. It's my job is to learn about it and to be better. And what was interesting is the guy who beat me out for the job was a black guy. And he was a year younger than me. We played on the same teams growing up. So it's not like I didn't know him. But what I realized looking back, it was like that moment in a movie where you have the flashback and you see everything in a different light and you see it from somebody else's perspective. He wanted to play quarterback and they never let him. I mean, it wasn't like my call. Like, of course I'm out there. I want to play quarterback too, right? Everybody wants to play quarterback, but the coaches never let him. And there's the only reason I can come up with, I mean, I'm sure they had some other pretextual reasons or whatever. The only reason I can come up with is because, he's black. And that's crazy to think that like, I was in that position as like the, I was like, and if this were like a high school football movie, I was the bad guy, white guy, like keeping the whatever down and didn't know I was because of systematic racism in a sport that means the world to me. And you still see that kind of racism in the NFL today. And you still, you know, it took a while to get past the like all white quarterback NFL, which is just like a preposterous position to be in when the league's 70% black. So I think about that a lot in sports and the protest movement and everything we've seen, Colin Kaepernick and all of that. I think back a lot about that and that world from the guy who beat me out for the job in high school's view. Like, holy shit, that's a lot to go through. Well, that's a lot of things to be like, you can't play quarterback because you're black. What the heck? So I've learned.
Yeah, definitely. Now, was your school very white or was it also – or was it more very – racially diverse?
Oh, my school was super racially diverse. And I personally had like the locker room was divided. So I was a sophomore going into the varsity locker room and I went early to get my, you know, like a week before practice started to get my seat. And the locker room is divided in half. All the white guys sit on one side and all the black guys sit on the other side. But I was a sophomore. I didn't know that. They didn't let freshmen into the locker room. So this is my first time in the varsity locker room. And so I go around and I look and I'm like literally the first person picking up their equipment and getting a locker, and I look around and I find the perfect locker. It's got all the hooks. It's near the air conditioning unit, but it's not too close to like the thoroughfare down the middle because you don't want to be in that, right? So I found the perfect locker, and then I show up on the first day of practice, and my stuff's hanging in my locker. But I walk in, I'm 10 minutes early to get my pads on, and everybody's been there for 30 minutes. Like, I didn't realize how early people got to practice. Like, they literally got to practice at like 6 o'clock, and I got there at like 6:15 or something. for a practice that started at 7 or something like that. Anyway, and so I walk in and I'm like, oh no, all the black guys are on the left side of this room and all the white guys are on the right side. And I'm the only white kid on the black side. My school was really diverse, and the question one of the seniors asked me was, do you listen to rap? And I totally do. I still do to this day. And the Wu-Tang double album was our like anthem for that whole season, because it had just come out. It was a really racially diverse school, and that wasn't a problem. And I didn't ever view myself as that. And I really was so unaware of the kind of structural racism that got to that point, because I just was like, well, I like black people, I'm not racist, which I think is, you know, generally true. Obviously, we all have blind spots and things to learn, but like, it was an interesting experience.
Did you ever have any issues being on that side of the locker room, or was it kind of like, he's cool, he likes rap?
No, it was no problem. In football, and this is one of the things I feel I credit football to, I learned so much about racism and not being racist through football, because I got exposed to people of different colors, and you don't always get that if you're in the honors track for other reasons that have to do with racism too. But you know, you don't always get that. And football allowed us to be all equal, and I don't give a shit what color you are. Just please block or tackle or whatever we're doing, do that. In fact, the coolest thing was, is my sophomore year, there was a varsity quarterback, a black guy, who was my kind of mentor and in all of this. And so he was a senior, he was good. He went on to play college ball, really nice guy. And, he injured his ankle in the second game of the season. And I came in and threw a touchdown pass like 2 plays later. And the receiver who caught it is a guy named Mike, and Mike freestyled rap. Like, he was a genius at it. He was so good, so funny, so I wish I could catch up with him and know what he's doing today, because he's a really interesting dude. Mike made this whole freestyle rap about how John wouldn't throw him the ball the first game, and Brian comes in and in 2 plays throws him the ball, and it's a touchdown. It was really fun. So, yeah, it wasn't any racial tensions or anything on my – it didn't come from that place for me.
That's really wholesome to hear, and I appreciate you sharing those stories and explaining what that was like. Now, when you graduated high school, what has your experiences been since that you are now really into electoral reform?
Yeah, so actually, my senior year of high school, while I was not playing football anymore, the thing that really captured my imagination and my first political hero was John McCain. And for those of you who know John McCain from like the 2008 campaign, I don't really recognize that guy as much. The John McCain in 1999 was like the straight talk express, Mr. Maverick, tell it like it is. And I liked politics, but didn't have definitive political views. Naturally came from a Republican household, so I would have identified as that. But like, I didn't particularly think that any party was great. And I didn't know all the things. You know, I didn't have an opinion about national defense policy or taxation or environmental, but I had no clue about that stuff. But what John McCain was talking about was something more fundamental. He was talking about money in politics. And what was so cool about him was he just wasn't throwing bombs at the other side. That's easy to do in politics. He was actually calling out his own side for taking a bunch of like oil and gas money subsidies and things like that. Like, he really hit the Republicans on their corruption and their pork barrel spending, while simultaneously calling out, and with, I thought, a lot more credibility because he called it out on his own side, calling out Bill Clinton for renting out the Lincoln bedroom for $100,000 in soft money donations to the DNC. Like, that was a thing that happened. And I just thought, like, you know, it doesn't matter what your views are on tax policy or whatever you want to say. Like, if we can't have a non-corrupt government, we can't even have an honest conversation about those really important topics that people do care about. And so John McCain and campaign finance reform was my first like thing into politics that I was like, yeah, this is just right and wrong. This isn't left and right. I followed that for quite some time. I went to college. McCain-Feingold got passed that first year, my first year of college, I think. And then immediately was gutted by, and Mitch McConnell is like such the bad guy in so many political stories nationally, by a court case called McConnell v. FEC. A couple years later, I go to law school. the summer before I go to law school in 2008, Citizens United comes down, which everybody's aware of, and completely guts the rest of the McCain-Feingold reforms. Not that they were everything. You don't get everything you want through a legislature. But I was in law school, and I took a lot of election law classes. And it doesn't take long scratching the itch of just democracy reform and things like that to find a lot of other things that we should be doing to fix our system. Because at the point that Citizens United happened, like, there's not a lot you can do in campaign finance reform majorly at a national level to stop it, to stop money in politics. You can curb it a little bit, but you can't solve the problem, so to speak, because of that robust interpretation of the First Amendment.
So I know nothing about law school. I have no desire to go to law school.
That's good. So, we don't need any more lawyers.
So, you know, you said that you had a lot of these classes that talked about electoral reform. So what was law school like? Like, what were you doing and what were you learning about?
So first year of law school is there's a set curriculum. So you go in there and you take all the same courses as your peers, and there's no electives, so to speak. So it's constitutional law, it's contracts, it's torts, it's civil procedure, it's all the things. And that really sets you up for if you did well on this, you're going to get a clerkship. And if you didn't do well on this, you won't. And I had gotten married just as you probably you remember, I'm sure, the wedding, but that summer Citizens United came down, Kelly and I got married. And so I was newly married in law school, and a lot of kids go straight through from college to law school. I took 4 years off. So for some people it was like their extra senior years. And for me, I was like, oh, I'm married and like older, and that seems weird. So, law school was fine, but it wasn't the big, like, party and drinking all the time thing that it is for others. But I also wasn't that studious either. But I really did like all the election law classes I took, and we had a really robust election law society at William & Mary Law School, that I got involved in early, and just the best speakers came. Like, I got to meet Trevor Potter in law school, and Trevor was the former chair of the Federal Elections Commission. But more importantly to me, he was Stephen Colbert's lawyer for his super PAC. And he would appear on the Colbert Report as the straight man for Stephen to make fun of campaign finance reform and the need for it. And so, like, I got to meet a lot of cool people through that.
That's great that, you know, entertainment plays such a strong hold on our opinions and our thoughts, that that's what you cared about. He was on Stephen Colbert. You know, this is the guy to look for. So since law school, what has your path taken you through? I know you've done a couple different things. So can you explain what it's been like since?
Yeah. So, you know, I started law school in the fall of 2008. That's when the recession hit big time. And then there's this backlog of legal jobs because when I was a 1L, the 2 and 3Ls were all, you know, had jobs and stuff like that lined up, and everything got frozen. So there was this really big backlog and an over, just way too many law students at the time, feeding a market that didn't need that many. So I went and practiced at a small firm. It was the most miserable 15 months ever. I'm just not good at that. It's just not what I wanted to do. It wasn't fulfilling. The people there were great. And in fact, I still talk to the old managing partner. I had a nice email exchange with him where he sent me an email and was like, congratulations on your big success, which we can talk about the gerrymandering stuff in a minute. But it was so nice. He was like, and I remember thinking, I was like, I remember walking into your office being like, I suck at this. And he basically told me that too. And I was like, I got to leave. And he was like, you do. So, you know, then I kind of floated around and worked in like the startup community in Richmond and did a lot of work with some business folks and just, you know, connecting people and doing neat things. And I ended up at a great company called the Fahrenheit Group, which does some neat things in town and in kind of in the Mid-Atlantic region. And I was very happy there, and I was helping to, you know, expand them to different markets. And then I got an opportunity from somebody I really respect in Virginia politics who was like, Brian, you need to come run this anti-gerrymandering group in Virginia. And I was like, no, I don't. That sounds like a lot of work. And I would have to fundraise for my job, and I would travel all over the state, and it seems like a really long shot that we'd have any success. This person, she's very persuasive, and she is, I don't think anyone ever says no to this person. And, so I ended up taking the job, In January of 2015, I started, which is crazy.
And is that the job that then led you to the success last March?
Yeah. So this is this 2020 was the kind of culmination of all of that work. The goal of the organization, the organization's One Virginia 2021, the goal was to reform our redistricting process in Virginia. And the only way to do that is a constitutional amendment through the state constitution. A lot of states in this country can do amendments to their constitution through what's called a citizens initiative. And if you remember that back to high school, it's when people get together, they sign a petition saying we want, I don't know, marijuana to be legalized. And then they get, you know, 100,000 people to sign the petition that says we want marijuana to be legalized. They put it on the ballot and people vote on it and it is or it isn't legalized. Virginia doesn't have that option. We've got to go through the state legislature and they have to pass a resolution saying they want to amend the constitution. And they have to do it not only once, but they have to have an election in between and then come back and do it again. So we have to pass it twice and then it goes to the ballot. So it's a long process to try to get it through.
So, you know, you mentioned that you had to fundraise for your job. So what were you doing in this job that was a goal for redistricting in Virginia?
So fundraising for your job, by the way, is sucks. But fundraising for not only your job, but your coworker's job is a lot of pressure. And we were really fortunate to have some startup capital in this organization. I think they had about 80 grand in the bank when I started. So that was helpful. But our real goal was to build a movement for this that the political establishment just couldn't ignore. And because nobody wants to change redistricting, you know, like the party out of power sometimes does. But at the end of the day, anybody who got elected, whatever system got you elected, you probably like. Like that's it could be anything. As long as it got you elected, it must have been a fair system, right? And so you're overcoming that on both sides of the aisle. So we really put forward the issue in terms of this is a bipartisan issue. This has nothing to do with Democrats or Republicans. This is not left-right. This is really right-wrong. And we're like, we got to build up a grassroots army for this. And that grassroots army has to make small monthly donations to the cause to help sustain it, because also all the business interest and otherwise that if you were starting up a worthy nonprofit would write you a 4 or 5 figure check to get you going, and you could go collect a bunch of those and fund your organization. They're not going to do that if what you're doing is a fundamental threat to the powers established in your state legislature, right? And that's what we were doing. Was, and I don't think it was actually that a threat, because I think the only people that have to worry about fair districts are mediocre politicians. Gerrymandering just protects mediocre politicians. So if you think you're better than mediocre, and they all do, you'll be fine. But that's not how they see it exactly. So yeah, we ended up building. So we when I took over, we had about 3,500 supporters, and as of today, we have over 120,000. We had 104 people who had given us money, and by now we've got 5,400 people who have given us money. And most of those donations, aside from a couple of really big foundations that got in as the campaign started going on, most of those donations come from, you know, average folks writing a check, just like Kelly and I do when we support a cause, where we'll write a $50 check or a $100 check or maybe a $250 check if it's a friend running for office, and then we'll be like, ugh, that was a lot. Right. But that's where most of our funding comes from, which makes me happy, because that's not only is that sustainable and it's a sign of a really healthy organization, but it's how it should be. Right. People should want this reform, and we've got to exercise our muscles to do that. And in Virginia, we did.
So what is the state of gerrymandering currently in Virginia?
So we passed the resolution through the legislature. Our legislature meets in January through March every year. And so we passed it in 2019. They had an election. The Democrats took back over the chamber. The Republicans were barely in charge before, but the Democrats took over the chambers and were now in charge of the General Assembly. We passed again. It was a brutal fight in March to get it through. The Senate was good. The House of Delegates was, we had a lot of Democratic delegates change their mind on the amendment after they became in the majority. And so it was a brutal fight through that. And we and then that put it on the ballot this November, and we ran a big vote yes campaign, vote yes on one, and it was successful. And so as of the certification of that election, so like November 11th of 2020, Virginia's constitution changed the way it redistricted. The way it had always been is redistricting happens once a decade based on the U.S. Census, and it goes through a process just like how a bill becomes a law. So a legislator, blah, blah, blah. The reality is they do it all in a smoky back room, and they don't let anybody know about it, and then they unveil the map, and then people vote on it right away, and then the governor signs it, and that's law. Now, Virginians will have an open, transparent process, a seat at the table. Racial gerrymandering is illegal under Virginia law for the first time in 400 years. Partisan gerrymandering is structurally impossible under this because it is a bipartisan commission and you need a supermajority of votes to get anything through. There's no smoky back room anymore. And we've got citizens at the table running the commission with an equal say with the legislator. So it's a 16-member commission, 8 citizens, 8 legislators. The chair of the commission, which should be chosen in the next couple weeks, will be a citizen. And there's some really – we've just finally, as of this week, seated all the – the full commission has been chosen, and they're great. There's some really awesome citizens a part of this. One of them is from Richmond, and she's the CEO of the Better Housing Coalition in the greater Richmond area. Like, she's phenomenal. She served on the board of visitors at Virginia Tech. Like, I can't believe how qualified these commissioners are, and it's everything I could hope for.
So then what is the timeline that, you know, everything – will come together and the maps will be better?
Yeah, so everybody around the country draws their maps based on the U.S. Census data. And there's a lot of states that have reform now. Virginia's the first of kind of the next wave of states, which are states that have to go through their state legislature to do it. Most of the states that have gotten redistricting reform, like California or Arizona or Michigan, are states that they did the citizens initiative process. Not to say that that wasn't hard too, but they didn't have to go through their legislator to do it. But so maybe we're the a model for some other states like Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, Maryland, Pennsylvania. Maybe we've got a model there with what we did, and I hope that's inspiring to them because all the states that went before us were inspiring to us. But the timeline is this: the commission in Virginia is up and running as of this week. They were all selected, so they have to have their first meeting this month in January. And then they don't have to do anything until the census data arrives. And usually the census data arrives because the census is taken in years ending in zero. In Virginia, the U.S. Census Department usually gives Virginia and New Jersey, because we have off-year elections, they give us the census data early. And that means like February or maybe March. But because of the Trump administration's inability to properly run a U.S. Census, and then COVID hit, and no one was going to be able to properly run a U.S. Census in that. Because of that, the census is really delayed, and we don't know how delayed it will be, but the next timeline in the Virginia redistricting process, the starting gun for that timeline is the arrival of the census data, and it may not be until May or June. And then they start a 2 to 3 month process of drawing the maps in a way that'll be a lot better for Virginia, but we just don't know when that'll start exactly. So what I hope the commission does in between now and then is actually have public hearings, because you don't need the data to have public hearings and say, hey, this is your current map. What do you think? Oh, it's bad. Why is it bad? Okay, that's good to know, right? Like, they could do that at any point.
And what does a good map look like in I don't know if that would be in your opinion or in general?
Well, there's an art to it, right? And then there's some real science behind it as well, because you can measure a lot of things. Here's what I'll say: the kind of like thesis of redistricting reform is these voting districts should reflect the community, not some incumbent politician's reelection strategy. And when you let the politicians do it in the proverbial smoky back room, all you get is protecting someone's electoral strategy, right? That's all you get. And so where we've had redistricting reform in other states, what you see is you see districts that just logically look better, right? They don't look like some Rorschach ink blot test. They look a lot more compact. But just because something's compact doesn't mean it actually reflects a community, because we live in weird places. So there's kind of a there's an eyeball test to it, but then there's also some you know, hey, did you divide up a neighborhood? Did you divide up a bunch of small towns and cities to get this done? Did you, instead, you know, the better way would be to use major roads, right? You've got to, okay, some counties are big. You've got to divide them up just because they have so many people in it. They can fit a couple of different districts in there, but use the big roads, right? Don't go through somebody's neighborhood and squiggle out your primary opponent, which is what, used to happen. So yeah, so good maps are based on a community and a town and a city or a locality rather than someone's reelection strategy.
That makes a lot of sense. I, living in Pennsylvania, having not grown up in Pennsylvania, I very much, when I came in, was like, why are there so many different levels of like governance per se? Because you have like school districts, you have county, you have state, you have all these different things. And then it was like, and then the voting districts don't even match any of that. And it was like, what is even happening?
Yeah. Yeah. No, Pennsylvania is one of the most gerrymandered states in the union. A lot of us in the Mid-Atlantic are, because of a high population of minorities, mixed in with a lot of rivers and, you know, the Chesapeake Bay in Virginia and all the big rivers that divide Virginia and, you know, Pennsylvania to a lesser degree, but still, but yeah, we are, the Mid-Atlantic is some of the worst gerrymandering in the country. So that's why this reform in Virginia is so, hopefully we'll have some real ripple effects and it is meaningful.
Yeah, that would be a great goal. So what is next for you? So you know, had this great success at the beginning of last year. Where are you now and what are you looking forward to in the future?
One Virginia, the organization, the nonprofit I'm with and have been for 6 years now, is working on the implementation of this commission. We weren't just going to set it up and walk away. We helped publicize and educate people to apply to serve on the commission. We had over 1,200 people actually do that, which is really kind of cool. And then the commission set up. So now our job is kind of twofold. One, we want to be a watchdog on the commission because we want to make sure they'll do a good job. I think they will. The incentives and structures are all there for them to do the right thing, but somebody should be watching that, right? And we're in a good position to do that. And then two, and perhaps even more important, or maybe it feeds the first, is we now have structures and opportunities for public input unlike we've ever had before. Structurally because of this reform, but also just technologically because the mapping software and the tools to draw districts used to be in the kind of like high priesthood of gerrymandering political consultants. But now that technology is kind of filtered down, and like you go on davesredistricting.com and draw your own map if you want, right? So there's a lot of technology that people can use to participate in this. So those two things together should make this the most engaged and public input mapping we've ever had. That's a low bar, but it will be. And our job is to make sure that not only is that done, but it's done in an equitable way, because I don't really want just a bunch of rich, highly educated white people submitting maps saying this is how you should draw our state. Our state is more than that. We need to have other folks draw maps to reflect what their communities are and to talk about what would be beneficial to them. And I think about, there's a great example out of California. Watts is a neighborhood in LA, and it's a neighborhood that's traditionally black, and I'm sure it has a lot more flavors of that because it's California, but generally speaking, not a lot of white people in Watts, and it's an impoverished region. And there, before California got reform, the neighborhood of Watts, which is so like a small town, I guess, would be probably the way to put it, a mile, couple miles wide, whatever it is, was divided into three congressional districts. And it's just like, it's crazy to think that something that small, it easily should have just been in one. No, it was in three. So it was all fractured and cracked up. And Watts got this like crazy snowstorm, or LA did, right? And it was a number of years ago. It was like a freak, just like, that doesn't happen in LA. And of course, they don't have the equipment to solve it. So this is the time when you declare like a temporary natural disaster, the feds come in and help you clean up. Like that happens all over the country. Well, the people of Watts didn't know who to call because they had three congressional representatives, which really means they had zero because they were so fractured, because every representative of those districts was like, oh, well, that's like Watts is only like 2% of my district. So that's somebody else's problem. I'll let them put in the request for the natural disaster relief. Right. And they all said that. And so Watts had zero real representation there. So in the new maps, Watts is kept together and they're in one congressional district and they have a person who will respond to them because that is that person's job. And that's kind of what we're going for here. As for what's next for me, I don't know. This is important to finish up, but there's also a lot of other important reforms out there. And I would look for, I think what Alaska did was really, really powerful. And probably a lot of folks don't know what happened, but Alaska took a huge reform step this November. They passed a package of reforms, some prohibitions against dark money, which is good. They passed ranked choice voting, which is really good, which means you get to choose your first place candidate, your second place candidate, your third place candidate. And it would avoid the, we just had that big Georgia runoff that took for freaking ever, right? It would have allowed them to, ranked choice voting would allow them to do it in one election and not two spread out over whatever to torture Americans. So ranked choice voting in Alaska. And I think this is really important. They got rid of partisan primaries. So they now have open primaries in Alaska. So anybody who wants to run for an office can drop their name into the hat, can run, get the signatures they need, run in a primary. And the top four winners of that primary will go on to the general, in which case then you'll be able to rank rank choice vote on the top four. And so what that does is that means that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party don't have like a monopoly on controlling who gets on the November ballot. You could end up because there are four spots. You could have four Republicans. And if Alaska is that red, great. You'll have different flavors of Republicans, obviously, if you do that. Or you could have a Republican, a Democrat, a Green, and a Libertarian, right? Like that's possible too. And I think how important that is manifests last night in terms of Senator Murkowski from Arizona, from Alaska said, called on President Trump to resign forcefully after the Capitol riots and the attempted coup. And she said she might leave the Republican Party over this. And what's really interesting to see is I'm not sure she would have said that if Alaska hadn't taken that reform. And Lisa Murkowski doesn't want to be in the same party as Donald Trump. And honestly, that's probably very fair based on their political ideologies. And I'm not saying she's a Democrat like I am, but like she doesn't seem to be to fit the Republican Party either. However, Alaskans really like her. They wrote her in. She won in a write-in contest before. So like she's an impressive person and who represents Alaska well. And this top four in ranked choice voting system that Alaska has now that will affect her in 6 years or whenever, however many years when she runs, enabled her to say that I don't have to follow everything my party says. So I think that reform, that combination of reforms is really, really powerful. We're seeing in other places in general, but that's really powerful.
It sounds so powerful. And I knew kind of in general what she was talking about last night. So, I mean, we're recording on Saturday, January 9th. This is coming out in a few days, so it's not like we're going to be super delayed. But just to hear, you know, what she's gone through and how that's so good. And like you said, I mean, I mentioned earlier, I try to stay slightly away from politics. But all of this has been so much of a learning opportunity for me. And I really appreciate that. And so to hear what they're going through and what Alaska has passed and that for the most part, I didn't know any of it. And it all sounds so good. And I know with the election this last year, there was a lot of, well, I don't like either of the two choices. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people saying like, well, if you don't vote for one of them, then you're going to get the other person. And a lot of people weren't happy with that. And it was kind of like you were saying with the Democrat and Republican majorities that's just how it is right now.
That's called the spoiler effect. And that is one of the biggest things that ranked choice voting solves is it solves the spoiler effect because you can vote for a third party candidate without throwing your vote away. Because if they come in last, then your votes just get redistributed until somebody gets more than 50% of the vote. And so it's a much better system. New York City is doing it for the first time. They're electing their mayor sometime this spring. Maybe it was in June or something, May and June. And they're going to be using ranked choice voting for the first time ever, which is great. Maine has used it for a while. A bunch of small towns in Utah use it. And so it's starting to spread. It's a key component of kind of the system we have is broken, or it's not broken. It's working exactly as well. It's broken for our purposes as like getting common sense policy. But these are the reforms that we can do. They're not only smart and helpful, they're doable, right? It's not like we've got to get a U.S. constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. We should do that too. It's just not going to happen anytime in the near future. But we can do these other smart reforms to enable people like Lisa Murkowski to be the person that she wants to be, and to be the person that her constituents in Alaska have asked her to be.
Now, you kind of just explained it very shortly there about ranked choice voting. I feel like it's still this big, like, I don't get it, and it doesn't make sense, and why would you do that? So could you kind of dive in a little bit about what ranked choice voting is and how it works?
Sure. So there's all sorts of analogies about, like, hey, if you're going to buy a six-pack of beer for your friends for the day, for the, you know, for your, you know, watch a movie or something together, what beer are you picking? Right. And or there's pizza topping. I don't have any of those analogies well, though. Ranked choice voting, if you Google that, you'll get to some solutions that are kind of that explain it that way. The way I always explain it was the first presidential election that I ever paid attention to was in 1992. I was 10 years old and Bill Clinton was elected. But in this election, it was a really weird one because it was an incumbent president, George H.W. Bush, was running for re-election, and this kind of crazy Texas billionaire guy, Ross Perot, was also running. And Ross Perot was making a lot of sense to a lot of people. People really felt, the budget deficit was out of control. We got to get that into this. We got to run our government like a business. A lot of things Ross Perot was saying was really accurate. Obviously, Ross Perot was not running as a Republican or a Democrat. And there's a lot of debate in political science circles about whether Ross Perot pulled more votes away from Bill Clinton or from H.W. Bush. I don't know if we'll ever fully know that, but here's how ranked choice voting would have solved that problem. You could have gone into the voting booth and Ross Perot is your absolute favorite. You really want him to do it, but you know he's only polling in the 20s. So the odds of him winning are low. So you can walk into the voting booth and know that Ross Perot is your first choice, but maybe he's only going to get 20% of the vote. And he's not likely to get elected. And you can still vote for Ross Perot. And when he comes in last, because no one will have gotten 50% of the vote at that point, or 50% plus one, your second choice, whether it was Bill Clinton or H.W. Bush, your vote will be redistributed because Ross Perot comes in last. They redistribute all of Perot votes to those individual votes' second choice. So if you voted for Clinton and I voted for Bush, they would have been distributed accordingly. And you do that process until someone gets over 50%. And in this case, it would have, you know, it's a three person, it would have been one. But what's interesting about that is not only do you really get more choice as a voter and you avoid the spoiler effect, but I bet actually Ross Perot, who did get 20% of the vote nationally in that election, Ross Perot would have gotten more votes because I guarantee there are people who walked in that voting booth, just like your friend said about this election. I really want to vote for Ross Perot, but I don't want to throw my vote away. Right? Ross Perot might have gotten 30%. Of the election. And that would have really changed some things because Bill Clinton ended up winning that election with just 44% of the vote. And we can do better than that. We can have popularly elected leaders who actually reflect, you know, got some support from a majority of the crowd. I will say this, if the Republicans had used ranked choice voting, they would never have nominated Donald Trump. Ever. Because mm-hmm. He won because it was so fractured. Now, it doesn't work as well when you – and that's what ranked choice voting needs, that open primaries, feeding it, because they need that, like, not partisan primaries. Because if you only have a Republican and a Democrat on the ballot, ranked choice voting doesn't do you much good, right? It's not applicable. It's only applicable when you have four or five people on the ballot who are legitimate contenders, right? Like serious potential candidates. And that open primaries plus ranked choice voting – will really give voters a lot more choice and will incentivize our elected representatives to behave in ways that make sense rather than behave in ways that just make sense for their party primary.
Yeah, and I agree with what you said on, more people would have voted for him because I definitely was hearing it from the states that, like, you know, we're clearly going to go one way. They were like, well, because I don't like this candidate, I'm just going to vote for none of the not top two. And it was like, I'm like, well, I live in Pennsylvania. Besides the fact I was going to vote for Biden, like, my whole statement all along was, I am voting for the Democratic nominee. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't matter who it was. Like, that was just my stance because I wanted a change in presidency. And in Pennsylvania, it mattered.
Yeah, really.
I believe that's all the questions that I have for you before we start to wrap it up. Is there anything else that you would like to share with the listeners?
I think if you want to read more about any of these democracy reforms, and I hope everybody does, because I do think there's so many things in our politics that fracture us along partisan lines, and our politics is more fractured than our people are. I think we're not quite as divided as our politics would lead you to believe. And so there's two books I think are really awesome for kind of further reading. One is the author Dave Daly. He has a new book that actually just came out in paperback called Unrigged. And it's about the story of people taking their democracy back, realizing their state system is broken and we're going to do that. One of the most inspiring stories in there she's one of my political heroes, Katie Fahey, who ran Voters Not Politicians in Michigan. And she's just an amazing person. And Dave chronicles her stories well with a bunch of others. It's a really inspiring book. His first book was called Rat Effed, and it was more about the problem, and Unrigged is now about the solution, and I highly recommend that. And then the other one, if you're interested in learning more about that that open primaries and ranked choice voting prescription for things, this past summer, Catherine Gell and Michael Porter came out with a book called The Politics Industry, and I think they have a great nonpartisan but also pragmatic take on what's wrong with our system, what can we do to fix it, and here's how we can get it done. And I'm very excited about those prescriptions and think that everybody should take a hard look at them, because I think there's a lot of truth, and if you don't like what's going on in Congress, this is a way to fix that.
Awesome. And I will make sure to leave both of those book titles and authors in the description so the listeners can easily find them. Now, with all of my guests, I end with a fun, random question. Yours is going to be a two-part question.
Okay.
You've mentioned a couple of times that you're married to my cousin, actually, Kelly, and you do have two young children. So my two-part question is, what is your favorite show that they watch, and then what is your favorite TV show that is not for children?
So the favorite show that we've watched together, and I guess our daughter Catherine is only, well, she'll be a year next week, so she's not really into TV. But the show we watched with Bennett is Jurassic Park. Obviously, there's been a number of Jurassic Park movies. There's also a Camp Cretaceous series of Jurassic Park that fits in the universe, and it's really good. And it's so typical of Jurassic Park. It's like, oh, these kids are going out to see the dinosaurs, and then something goes astray. But it's really well written. It's really well done. And Bennett loves it. It's cartoons. But we've loved watching that with him. It's been really fun. That and Dino Dana have been phenomenal to watch with Bennett. Kelly and I have consumed a lot of TV since the pandemic. And So previously I would have told you my favorite show ever on TV was The West Wing, and I still think that's a pretty darn good one. But the show that just came out this past year, Ted Lasso, is, I think, hands down the best TV series ever in the history of TV series. And I will compare that to even if you take out Game of Thrones' horrible last season, right? Like, it's better than that. And what's so awesome about Ted Lasso is that it's Jason Sudeikis, who's just a genius, and he plays this American football coach who goes to England to coach a Premier League English football team, so a soccer team, and hilarity ensues. But what's better about it and so deep about it is he has a real philosophy on life, Ted Lasso, the character, as the coach, and about teaching people to be their best and being, you know, almost to the point of annoyingly saccharine and optimistic, but in a way that's really powerful and perhaps all the more needed for the time we're in. So I highly recommend Ted Lasso. It is a brilliantly written show. It won a lot of awards, so I think other folks agree with that. And I can't wait for season 2.
All right, that brings this episode to a close. As I mentioned, I will be leaving the information for those two books that Brian mentioned in the description. And if you'd like to connect with the podcast on social media, I highly recommend it. I'm trying to get those numbers up, and I know we have a lot of good listeners. So you can follow the page on Facebook, you can like the page on Instagram, and there is also a LinkedIn feed as well. And of course, if you would like to guest on the podcast, I'm always looking for new people. So don't feel like, you know, if you think you don't have a story, I'm still happy to share your life with the listeners. And you can just email the podcast at introducingmepodcast@gmail.com. And thank you so much to Brian for spending time with me today and for my listeners to taking the time out of your day to hear a new story. Until next time, bye.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Take care.